This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Free Expression with Jerry Baker.
Hello, and welcome to Free Expression from the Wall Street Journal. I'm Jerry Baker, editor-at-large of the Journal. If you're not already subscribing, please do sign up wherever you do your podcast listening. This week, is Israel losing the war? The idea seems both far-fetched and, we should say, slightly terrifying. Israel's defense forces have already eliminated thousands of Hamas fighters and killed many of its leaders, pushing deep into Gaza. The job isn't finished, and the Biden administration is upping the pressure on Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to agree to a ceasefire and halt the campaign to eradicate the terror group that slaughtered 1,200 Israelis on October 7th. This, even as Hamas holds on to around 100 of the hostages it took that day, and says, by the way, in response to a proposed deal brokered by the US, it doesn't even know what's happened to 40 of them. But yet somehow, as much of the global media portrays Israel as the aggressor, and with the Biden administration seemingly worried about losing the support of pro-Palestinian voters in November's election, the Jewish state is under heavy pressure from its supposedly closest ally in the world to wind down the military campaign. If Israel is bullied in this way and stopped from inflicting real defeat on the enemy that is committed and, remember, tried to destroy Israel, can it possibly win its larger struggle to survive? What will it mean if the only democracy in the region is unable to face down an enemy that's backed by the theocratic and expansionist regime in Iran? To talk about all this and the wider state of affairs in the Middle East, this week I'm delighted to say I'm joined again by my old friend and previous Free Expression guest, Ruel Marc Gerecht. Ruel is a senior fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies and a former fellow of the American Enterprise Institute. He writes frequently for the Journal editorial page, as well as for other publications, and is the author of several books on politics and society in the Middle East. Early in his career, he served as a case officer at the CIA. And Ruel Gerecht joins me now. Ruel, thanks very much for coming back to Free Expression.
My pleasure.
We're going to review Israel, the war, the wider Middle East. Let's start with the war itself and your assessment, as you see it, of what Israel has achieved. We know that Israel has killed thousands of Hamas fighters. The precise number obviously is not quite known, but it does seem a significant number. They've eliminated some of the leadership, particularly the leadership on the ground in Gaza, a lot of them, less so perhaps the political leadership, which after all has absconded elsewhere. They've inflicted massive damage on the materiel and the resources we can assume. The Israeli government still very much seems determined to push into Rafah to complete the job. How do you assess what Israel has achieved so far and maybe what remains to be done in terms of achieving its objectives?
Well, I mean, I think they have, as you said, damaged Hamas massively. Now, an organization like that has the capacity to rebound. And I think the most important thing for the Israelis is they're going to have to find all of the weapons stockpiles. Or otherwise, you know, they could be mowing the lawn in Gaza every fortnight. And they have a problem, and it will grow in size, and that the Israelis would really prefer not to occupy Gaza. But I don't see how any other course of action works. The Americans obviously aren't coming to save them. The Europeans aren't coming to save them. The Gulf Arabs certainly are. You're not going to have ANZAC mercenaries come in there and police Gaza. So I think the unavoidable default choice is going to be the Israelis are going to have to stay there for a while. That makes it imperative that they find those weapon stockpiles. It makes imperative that they seize control of Rafah. It makes it imperative that they ensure that those tunnels going into Egypt, which I suspect are still active, have been definitively shut down.
What do you make of Netanyahu said the IDF plan to go into Rafah some weeks ago now? Obviously, there's tremendous diplomatic pressure being exercised by the US, and the US's Kamala Harris and the president himself sort of intimated that Rafah would somehow be some sort of a red line. Obviously, given the number of civilians there, we know that there would obviously be more collateral civilian damage there. But what do you make of this delay? Do you think it's tactical? Do you think it's intended to appease the Biden administration? You've said it's essential to go into Rafah. What are they waiting for?
First and foremost, I think the Israelis, Netanyahu, and the IDF general staff are nervous about going in there. It is going to be a very, very difficult fight. And they have, as is apparent, come under increasing pressure from the Americans not to do it. I think the Americans have come to the conclusion that the Israelis cannot eliminate Hamas in Gaza, and that this battle could be even more of a PR catastrophe. So I think the Americans have sort of lost hope. I mean, urban warfare is extremely difficult. And as you mentioned in your fine op-ed, I mean, this type of warfare, and there's nothing worse, and the Israelis are going to have a very, very hard time doing it. So it's natural that they've been hesitant to do so. However, if they don't do it soon, I think they could lose momentum, and that would be a serious mistake, because we know there are substantial weapons stockpiles there. A lot of the leadership is there. And the theory that is now circulating, I think coming out of the White House, that somehow the Israelis can not go into Rafah and then periodically go in and attack Rafah and eliminate the leadership, I just think is silly. It's just not going to work. I mean, they'll be mowing the lawn all the time. And I think from a PR standpoint, it would be almost as bad or worse. It would be never ending. That they have to go in, they have to get this over with.
You said that the US has probably concluded that Israel can't actually defeat Hamas, so certainly not this way. You laid out very well, they've killed a tremendous number of Hamas fighters. There's still more to be done. Obviously, the rebuttal to that is, well, because of the civilian casualties, and I would argue because of the weight of highly partial public opinion against Israel, they've kindled even more powerful anti-Israeli sentiment among Palestinians. We always used to say that the war against Iraq was a recruiting sergeant for Al-Qaeda. And presumably the analysis is the same here, that for every civilian they kill, they probably create another 10 Hamas fighters. What's your sense of that? And indeed, of the feasibility of the Israeli objective of destroying Hamas?
If the Israelis are willing to go in there and occupy Gaza, something that they absolutely don't want to do because occupation is toxic. But I don't think they have a choice because no one's coming to the rescue. So I think by default, they're going to have to do that job. If they occupy Gaza, if they shut down all the tunnels and they ensure the weapon stockpiles are destroyed, yes, you could have a low-grade insurgency continue for quite some time, but it's going to be low-grade. It's not going to rise to the level that is a fundamental threat to Israel. You know, the Israelis have to make up their mind, and understandably, they have been reluctant to do so. They haven't put forward a post-war plan for very understandable reasons, is that when they go through the alternatives, none of them are very pleasing. Now, I'm not terribly persuaded by the argument that this is going to create a generation of terrorists. I mean, I think you can destroy terrorist organizations. Islamic history is full of insurgents, and almost all of them have lost. When they come up against a resolute force, that resolute force usually wins. There are some exceptions, but usually the greater power triumphs. So I'm dubious about this turning into an engine of terrorism against Israel. I think its protections there are pretty solid. It does have a concern about the West Bank, no question about it. I mean, I don't know what their deployment patterns are at this moment, but I believe they have more IDF units on the West Bank than they have in Gaza, considerably more. That's a problem for Israel. I mean, they haven't had a great deal of violence on the West Bank, but if that were to erupt, then that's the type of insurgency that could be very problematic because it's so close to Israel. And also, using so many IDF units to control that type or stop that type of turmoil would also effectively mean they can't go into Lebanon. And if they don't go into Lebanon, then all of those Israelis, somewhere between 65 and 100,000 Israelis who've had to flee the northern borderlands, will not go back. And they will have a permanent low-yield duel with the Hezbollah, which is exactly, for example, what Iran wants to see continue.
If you're right, Israel does really have to occupy Gaza, and a lot of logic to that argument. What does that do to the sort of the wider diplomatic, which is insofar as it matters? I mean, what would the response of Arab governments in the region be? Most importantly, how do you think the U.S. would regard that?
Oh, I think the U.S. would be hostile to it, but I think there is a realization, growing one, that all of the alternatives really don't work. I mean, a lot of the Americans, certainly the administration, seem to be going back to the tried and true formula of restarting peace negotiations with somebody in the Palestinian side to create a pathway to a two-state solution. I think that's dead as a door now.
Who would they talk to? I mean, Abbas is, you know, rotting away.
We don't know the popularity of Fatah, the main organization in the PLO. I suspect it's almost as low as the standing of Abbas. It's entirely conceivable that if you had a free election, Hamas might still win.
Yeah.
So we have gotten hooked on the idea that we have to have a two-state solution, where I think the answer is the Israelis are just going to have to muddle through. And no one likes that. It's ugly. And it's a huge problem, I think, for Israel and the United States, certainly with the left, maybe even with the right. I don't know. Israel is obviously in a pickle with Europe. But I think all of this is unavoidable. And what the Israelis have to focus on is what is the best way that they can ensure that they don't have missiles coming from Gaza into Israel, and that they reestablish a secure border, and they choke off. This is paramount. They choke off supplies from Egypt, because I think the Egyptian military has proven itself profoundly incompetent and unreliable, and they can't take that risk again.
What do you make of the political conditions inside Israel itself? We know Netanyahu is extremely unpopular, has been for some time, and certainly, you know, is at least up to now, until we get a full accounting, I suppose, certainly by many Israelis held responsible for the security failures. Obviously, Hamas were responsible for what happened on October 7th, but in domestic political Israeli terms, Netanyahu is clearly seen as liable on that. It looks as though, if there were an election, he would be ousted. There is, however, obviously a coalition government while the war goes on. If we are in for the long haul here, exactly as you describe, with a kind of ad hoc occupation of Gaza, and again, a winding down of the major hostilities, but a continued state of military engagement, how do Israeli politics right now, how do they handle that? Does that mean Netanyahu stays? Does Benny Gantz take over? I mean, how do you see that playing out?
I mean, those are good questions. I mean, I find Israeli internal politics befuddling, because Israelis are capable of endless political fission. And Netanyahu, though he's certainly become a liability, does have many attributes of the undead. He's extremely difficult to get rid of. And I don't think his removal, though advisable, is going to change some fundamental facts. There'll be some cosmetic changes. It will immediately improve a bit the Israeli alliance with the United States. It'll be cosmetically pleasing in Europe. But the fundamentals that the Israelis have to deal with, I don't think change, though I would love to blame Bibi Netanyahu for a lot of the bad stuff that's transpired from October the 7th. I think, to be fair to him, much of this was beyond his control.
What about the U.S.? You know, you've studied U.S. policy, you've been engaged in U.S. policy in many ways in the region, and you know well Tony Blinken and Jake Sullivan and the others, and many of the others who are involved in this, and obviously President Biden himself. Where are we? To the outsider, it does look, you know, the administration was strongly supportive of Israel right at the start. Biden came out very strongly, both rhetorically and logistically, by sending, you know, naval support to the region, and of course, all of the anti-missile defenses and everything else that U.S. has been contributing. And then steadily, obviously, particularly as these civilian casualties have risen and public pressure and domestic political pressure has risen, does seem to be backing off. You know, aside from the domestic politics of this, do you think the U.S. has got a coherent approach now in terms of what it actually expects? As you say, you've already explained why I think the two-state solution seems to be a non-starter, but what do you think they're trying to do?
Well, I think the overarching objective for this administration has been and remains doing less in the Middle East, not more. And then you have the added complication of the November election. And Jake Sullivan is certainly one of the most politically attuned NSAs, National Security Advisors, the United States has ever had. So he's always, always thinking about domestic politics. And I think those folks wake up every day and they say, what could happen in the Middle East that could help Donald Trump? And I think in their minds, the answer to that is war. So they're going to de-escalate, not escalate. They're going to try to avoid greater commitments. And I think people misanalyzed, for example, their sort of late embrace of Israeli-Saudi normalization. They saw that as a vehicle actually of reducing U.S. presence in the Middle East, not increasing it. Now, I think that's dead as a doornail for the time being, but still they are going to go down that path because it's at least in theory solves some of their problems. But I think they're just simply going to avoid at all possible greater U.S. engagement with the Israeli-Palestinian problem. They're going to avoid certainly getting into any type of shooting war with Iran. So there is a consistent theme here. In that sense, it's coherent. I don't know if it's excessive. I would say it's not going to be successful in the mid or the long term, but it might be successful in the short term. And I think that's all they care about. And that is no big problems before November.
Are you concerned that this increasing pressure that they're exerting on Israel now to back off, you know, with the job, as we've just discussed, not really finished? What does that tell us, do you think, about, especially if Biden were to be reelected in November, should that concern those of us who regard Israel with some justification as not only our greatest ally in the region, but the bulwark of democracy and our values and principles in the region? I mean, how much is that under threat, do you think, by what's going on now?
I certainly think it's under threat. We can see the direction that the American left is going. The American right's a bit more complicated on the Middle East. Now, the Israelis do benefit from a great deal of cognitive dissonance inside of the administration on Israel. I mean, on one hand, they are telling the Israelis they need to stop. On the other hand, they're also resupplying them quite substantially. I mean, some Israelis believe that they've received enough weaponry to actually engage in a war in Lebanon. Others are a bit more cautious about what their stockpiles actually are and what would be required. So the administration isn't of one mind. It's of at least two, maybe more. So for Israel's purposes, I suspect that's a good thing. But the direction that the Democratic Party, the left, is going, I think is probably more in the direction of, say, what Senator Van Hollen represents. It's not Biden's old school Zionism. I think that is on the way out. And that's a problem for Israel because Israel's alliance with the United States has always depended upon a bipartisan position. And certainly for older Israelis, it's a bit disconcerting because the bedrock of that relationship was always with the Democratic Party, not the Republican.
We're going to take a break there. When I come back, I'll have more with Ruel Gerecht on Israel's war against Hamas and the wider implications for the Middle East. Stay with us.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
You're listening to Free Expression with Jerry Baker. Don't forget, you can listen to the latest episode anytime on your smart speaker. Just say, play the Opinion Free Expression podcast. Now, back to Jerry Baker.
Welcome back. I'm talking with Ruel Gerecht, Middle East scholar, former CIA case officer. We're talking about the war in Gaza, but also about the wider implications of all of this for the Middle East and indeed for U.S. strategy and policy in the region. Let's talk about the wider region, and that brings us straight to the door of the mullahs in Tehran, of course, about subject about which you know a lot and you've written a lot. And let's start on that with the continuing lingering question that's kind of hanging over us. Oh, a couple of weeks ago, Israel struck and killed leading Iranian military figures in the embassy in Damascus, the IRGC, key members of the IRGC. Iran is sworn to a reprisal. What do you expect?
I think the Iranians are going to continue with a sort of a low-grade war against Israel, which they have found quite satisfying. I think it's always important to remember that the Supreme Leader, Ali Khamenei, has been quite, you know, precise in his description of how he sees that war unfolding. And that is, Israel perishes through a long confrontation, through a slow bleeding of Israeli happiness and foreign investment. It doesn't die in some nuclear catastrophe, not some enormous battle between the two of them. So using that standard, then I think the Iranian policy, this axis of resistance, its ring of fire, has been pretty successful. And I would expect them to continue it, but they don't want to escalate. The Iranians have certainly shown that they are scared of Israeli escalation. And because the Israelis have gone somewhat biblical on Gaza, I think the Hezbollah is nervous about the same thing happening to them. And the Iranians would be nervous too, because the Hezbollah is their favorite child. It's the indispensable child. And I don't think yet Nasrallah wants to go back and have a repeat of 2006, where he was forced into a mea culpa because of the Lebanese, sort of disgust of what happened. I don't think they want to see another major land invasion. So they want to maintain a low boil. And I think that gives them a great deal of satisfaction. For the Israelis, on the other hand, that's a bad situation.
Just on the specifics, though, Iran, again, has failed to respond to that particular attack. We recall that when, in Donald Trump's presidency, the U.S. took out Soleimani, the Quds leader, there was a kind of very surgical response, wasn't there, Bahrain? It seemed that the U.S. was notified in advance. It didn't really result in any significant, and it certainly didn't result in any escalation. First of all, you do think Iran will respond to that, to the Damascus attack? And secondly, again, would you expect it, given what you've just said about their unwillingness to escalate, that it, again, will be of the sort of same commensurate surgical kind of response?
Yeah, I mean, they have to respond. I've been reading Revolutionary Guard Corps sites, which are usually the best insights into this. And I think they're not going to go for something that would provoke the Israelis into a direct attack on Iran. So ideally, they'd like to blow up some Israeli or American diplomatic facility. That would give them a great deal of satisfaction. Now, that is always harder to do than it is today. So the truth about Iran is that its proxies are pretty good in the Middle East. Outside of the Middle East, they're not so good. Iran's intelligence networks are pretty good, sometimes excellent. In the Middle East, they're not so good outside of the Middle East. So the targets they can choose from are somewhat limited. I don't think they want to do anything with the Biden administration that would lead them or oblige them to attack Iran directly. So I think that's going to be off the table. There is the factor of the Iranian nuclear program, and that is, where is it? And my view is that they are very, very close to making a weapon, that they have everything they need, and the supreme leader may not have given the green light for them to finally assemble a device. If that's true, then I think they obviously don't want to provoke anything that could escalate into attacks upon their nuclear facilities at this late date. It's an interesting duel, particularly with Israel, because the Iranians have so many missiles now in Lebanon, and they may have moved in successfully medium-range missiles into Syria. It's hard to know there because the Israelis are constantly bombing them in Syria. They have so many, upwards of 100,000, 150,000 projectiles. They may have already deterred Israel with their conventional capacity, and that's quite something. I mean, you have a conventionally armed foe that is actually deterring a nuclear-armed one. So we have to see. I mean, I think the Israelis still have within them the capacity to escalate and escalate quite rapidly. But I know it's without a shadow of a doubt, the IDF is deeply worried about that missile capacity, that perhaps the Hezbollah and the Iranians could pincushion Tel Aviv before the Israeli Air Force could suppress those launchers.
Again, if you're right about what you've said about Israel needing a kind of a long-term occupation of Gaza, kind of maybe continuing the sort of a low-grade kind of military, low-grade war, with presumably continuing responses, you know, across the northern border from Hezbollah, continuing tensions with Iran, what's your sense of how the balance of power has changed and will have changed in the region over the last 6 months? I mean, has Israel done enough to demonstrate to its many enemies in the region not only its willingness, but its ability to strike back and to maintain its security? Or have the events of the last 6 months somehow changed that wider picture, whether it's with the Iran-Israel tension, with Iran's proxies, maybe even with some of the Arabs. Give us a broad picture of how you see the balance of power and the way it has or hasn't shifted maybe over the last 6 months or so.
I mean, right now, I'd have to say that the battle in Gaza, the war, has redounded to Israel's advantage vis-a-vis the Hezbollah, which is Israel's, I think, biggest concern outside of a scenario where the Palestinians on the West Bank and Israeli Arabs were to engage in an intifada. The Hezbollah, because of all its missiles, is the single greatest threat to Israel now. And I think the war in Gaza, because it has been so destructive, is, I think, it probably has had a positive didactic effect. Now, vis-a-vis the nuclear program, I don't think Israel's war with Iran's proxies has any effect on the nuclear program. We saw that in 2006 after the Israelis smashed the Hezbollah. The Iranians immediately started expanding the nuclear program. Oh, we know that's when they started their clandestine nuclear site in Syria. That's also when they started the underground site, which is Fardol near Qom. So the Iranians responded by that, by actually increasing the nuclear tempo, which is what logically you would expect. So on one hand, yes, this war, I think, has helped Israel's cause against its primary local foes. Against the larger strategic question, I don't think it's helped much at all. And I think it has revealed that the diplomacy that the Israelis were hoping for to make a significant regional difference, primarily including the Saudis and the Abraham Accords, I think that's tanked, and it's probably tanked permanently. So I don't think that's a huge strategic loss to Israel. I disagree with those that thought that somehow the hope of normalization was going to make a big strategic difference for Israel. I dissent from that view. I think it was largely a mirage. But it is nevertheless, it has shown that the MBS isn't reliable. And the intrusion of the Chinese into the Middle East, the successful diplomacy that led to Iranian and Saudi rapprochement, the fact that the Houthis haven't been launching any missiles at Saudi Arabia, shows that the Americans certainly are less influential in the region, and that the locals have realized that. And that the alliance between Iran, China, and Russia is going to grow. It's gotten much tighter, and I see no reason why it won't get even more profound as time goes on. For those who think that's a bad thing for the West and a bad thing for the United States and the Middle East, that's not good. The prognosis there is not rosy at all. So it depends whether you want to emphasize the positive. The positive is yes, for Israel, I think the war in Gaza has been medicinal for those that would want to cause it immediate harm. But down the road, it's still a very difficult path for Israel, particularly if it thinks there's still time to turn off the Iranian nuclear program.
And given all of that, excellent summary. We've talked about what the Biden administration has been doing. You know, again, we may have 4 more years of Biden, or we may have 4 more years of Trump. If you were there, advise, what's the right thing for the U.S. to do, given the circumstances you've described?
I mean, I have sort of a primitive view of anyone who goes out and kills U.S. citizens, as the Iranians have done repeatedly, and that is you should rain hellfire down upon them. I think we're way past time of making the Iranians pay for their machinations. If I could rewind the historical tape, I truly wish George Shultz had won the debate in the Reagan administration in 1983 after the bombings of the Americans in Beirut, where Shultz argued for a direct response against Iran. He lost. Caspar Weinberger won. I think history might have been a bit different if the Americans had actually taken action against the Islamic Republic at that time. Again, I think it's overdue. The Islamic Republic, the clerical regime, has certainly deserved to be punished severely for its actions. I don't see that happening, however. I think the Americans, for very understandable reasons, have had quite enough of the Middle East. And I think the direction is still on both the left and the right is to do less, not more. So I don't see a fundamental change here. I think it's a question of whether the Americans slowly retrench or quickly retrench.
On that rather gloomy and sobering note, Ruel Mark Gorecht, thanks very much for joining Free Expression.
My pleasure.
Well, that's it for this week's episode of Free Expression. Thanks very much for joining us. Hope you'll join us again next week. In the meantime, have a great week.